Welcome to Criminalia, a production of Shondaland Audio in partnership with iHeartRadio.
Welcome to Criminalia, where it's pirate season. We're continuing to explore the lives and motivations of some of the most notorious freebooters throughout history. I'm Maria Tremarke.
And I'm Holly Fry. Historian Rodolfo Gill has written that today's pirate is considered to be, quote, one of the most important female figures of the Islamic West in the modern age. And there's even some debate about whether she should be categorized as a pirate. But we're going to get to that at the very end and just tell her story.
Right. Layla Aisha bint Ali ibn Rashid al-Alami was born in 1485 into a wealthy Muslim family in Granada, in the southernmost region of Andalusia in southern Spain. She would become known as Sayyida al-Hura, but before that, she likely went by the name Aisha. Layla, though it may appear as one to our English speakers, isn't actually a name. It's an Arabic Moroccan word that means miss or misses or lady, something along those lines. Aisha's father was a Muslim nobleman who claimed to be a direct descendant of the Prophet Muhammad. Her mother, Zora, was a Christian-born Spaniard who had converted to Islam. Aisha also had a brother, Muley Ibrahim.
So let's get into her time and place. It was only about 30 years before her birth that the Ottomans' capture of and subsequent fall of Constantinople marked the end of the Roman Empire. She was just 2 years old when the Portuguese started to capture and colonize ports on the western coast of Morocco, and she was only a year or two older when Queen Isabella I of Castile and King Ferdinand II of Aragon began forced conversions of both Jews and Muslims to Catholicism in both Spain and Portugal. Isabella and Ferdinand's marriage was one of political opportunism. Their union united all the regions of Spain and would go on to elevate the country as a serious world power. They reigned over a unified Spain jointly, and they became known as the Catholic monarchs.
Their expulsion of Jews and Muslims was deliberate in an effort to strengthen the Catholic Church as well as encourage religious uniformity and conformity under their rule. They established the Spanish Inquisition to force religious conversion through interrogation and torture. All of this was to benefit the crown.
Issued on April 29, 1492, an edict, which was called the Edict of Expulsion, called for the expulsion of the Jewish community. You basically had three choices. One, convert to Catholicism. Two, leave the country within 4 months. Or three, face execution by the Spanish Inquisition.
The forced conversions of Muslims were enacted through a series of edicts as well. 4 years after the Jewish community was expelled, Islam was outlawed across the lands of the Spanish monarchy. The campaign began in the city of Granada. This is the city where Aisha was born and had lived in her childhood, and was meant to create fear of torture and imprisonment. It triggered a rebellion among the Muslims living there, but Isabella and Ferdinand doubled down on their campaign. And in 1497, Portugal also began to order all Jewish and Muslim populations out of that country.
While Aisha was still young, just 7 years old, Muslims, including Aisha and her family, were forced to flee Andalusia after the Spanish Reconquista. That's the name of the Spanish movement to remove Muslims from the Iberian Peninsula, which was known as Al-Andalus by Muslims. The Reconquista, which translates to reconquest, spanned about 770 or 780 years of history of the Iberian Peninsula, and it was a series of campaigns by Catholic states to recapture land from the Muslims. At this late point in the ongoing Reconquista, Granada was the only region left to conquer.
Islam had been present on the Iberian Peninsula since the 8th century, and the attack and subsequent expulsion ended the nearly 800 years of Muslim presence there. Some who could not leave converted. Others claimed to convert but remained underground Muslims. The struggle between Muslim and Christian empires would have surely shaped Aisha's life.
Many refugees fled to northern Africa. Aisha's family did as well and settled in northwest Morocco, in the city of Chefchaouen, a few miles inland from the Moroccan coast. Actually, many who fled Spain settled there and together transformed Chefchaouen into a city that would become known as the Blue Pearl, That's a nickname given for the distinctive color they painted their buildings. Recorded by Algerian-born historian Al-Makari a century later, quote, many thousands of the unfortunate immigrants were absorbed by major North African urban centers such as Fez, Oran, and Tunis. Others who fled, he observed, quote, peopled the desert towns and districts of the country, such as Tetouan, Sela, and the plains of Metija near Algiers.
It was in Chefchaouen where Aisha was educated in theology, mathematics, languages, including Castilian and Portuguese, as well as other disciplines. Among her teachers was Moroccan scholar and architect Abdullah Al-Ghazwani, whose father, the equally celebrated Sheikh Ujjal, is said to have once put his hand on Aisha's head and declared, quote, this girl will rise high in rank. Today, Al-Ghazwani is honored in Sufism as one of the, quote, seven saints of Marrakesh. Those are seven figures who are said to have been blessed by Allah in ways that enabled them to guide their community.
We are going to take a break and have a word from our sponsor. When we're back, we will talk about the influence Aisha's first marriage had on her life.
Welcome back to Criminalia. Let's talk about when and why Aisha began calling herself Sayyida Al-Hora Hikmet Tetouan.
In the early 1500s, Aisha married Abu Hassan al-Mandari, a nobleman who was 30 years her senior. This may have been in 1501 when she was 16 years old, but other records actually place this marriage in 1510, so quite a bit later. This was not a marriage sprung from love. We've talked many times about how that kind of marriage wasn't really, you know, necessarily the thing at this time in history. This was, like many marriages, struck as a strategic alliance. Al-Mandari was the head of another noble family that had fled Spain, and their marriage had been arranged years prior, likely when Aisha was very young. Al-Mandari was a nobleman and a friend of her father and had been governor of Tetouan in northern Morocco since 1505.
The couple does, though, appear to have developed genuine affection for each other over their years together. Roughly 80 years earlier, fearing its strategic position, the Portuguese had attacked Tetouan. It was a former fortress, so that made sense, and they left it in ruins. As a couple, they rebuilt and improved the city and welcomed other Muslims to settle there. There's a version of the story that suggests it was Aisha's father who rebuilt the city and welcomed in fellow refugees. But whether it was father or daughter, today, the city's old town is now designated as a UNESCO World Heritage Site.
Aisha's husband treated her as an equal, and when he died in 1515, she inherited his duties. And this is when she took the title of Sayyida Al-Hora Hikmet Tetouan, which translates from Arabic into English as the Honorable Great Lady Governor of Tetouan. In fact, instead of using her given name, she is often referred to in historical records as Sayyida Al-Hora, which is actually a title, not a name. The confusion here is thought to be because non-Muslim historians didn't realize that that wasn't her name. But she also didn't correct them. After all, she was Sayyida Al-Hora. And as the fates would have it, though, she would be the last queen in Islamic history to rule independently.
As we've been talking about this season, piracy has been used throughout history as a tool of state policy, and Aisha's piracy was an action against the growing empires of both Spain and Portugal.
While we can't be exactly sure why she turned to piracy, it was very likely a few things. It's said that for the rest of her life, Aisha bore a grudge against those who had driven her family from her childhood home, which, sure, that makes sense. But it was also, at least in part, an offensive maneuver to defend her coastline. Morocco is the only African country with borders on both the Atlantic Ocean and the Mediterranean Sea, and she would have wanted to secure those positions, coastal lands as well as the Mediterranean trade routes, and to be ready to attack.
As part of her defense, she struck up a legendary and unprecedented partnership with Oruj Reis, perhaps better known to you as Redbeard. If you've been coming along for the ride with us this pirate season, then you've heard us talk about him. He's one of the Barbarossa brothers, infamous corsairs. He was, at least initially, a legitimate merchant, but when one of his brothers was killed in an act of piracy and he himself captured, he turned to privateering to seek revenge. Revenge is also a big theme that we have this season. With another brother, Hayreddin, Oruch became a state-sponsored corsair, which meant that they were getting paid for plundering enemy ships and, of course, for kicking back a little bit of the spoils, to the tune of one-third of the loot.
Oruch wasn't just in the revenge business. He also served as governor of Algiers, and between 1504 and 1510, he used his private fleet to help transport Muslim refugees from Spain to northern Africa, as the persecution of religious minorities on the Iberian Peninsula intensified. His generosity in doing so earned him the nickname of Baba Oruch, that's Father Oruch.
But the thing about Oruch was, Oruch Rhys was also a pirate.
We're going to take a break here for a word from our sponsor, and when we return, we will talk about Redbeard the Pirate.
Welcome back to Criminalia. Let's talk about how now is when we see Aisha grow into a pirate queen.
Aisha and Oruch partnered up, and they divvied up the region. Aisha began terrorizing the western half of the Mediterranean Sea, and Rhys the east. Together, the two dominated the Mediterranean, and Sayyida al-Hura's career in piracy was in full swing. During her reign, Morocco didn't have a navy, and she depended on privateers, pirates who were state-funded. And that meant she controlled the Barbary corsairs in her waters. Barbary pirates, or corsairs is a word we've been using, were Muslim pirates and privateers who operated from North Africa.
In the book The Forgotten Queens of Islam by Fatima Marnissi, she mentions Spanish historical documents of 1540 in which there were mention of negotiations, quote, between the Spaniards and Sayyida al-Hura after a successful pirating raid in Gibraltar where the crew stole, quote, much booty and many prisoners.
Aisha targeted Portuguese traders who, it said, quote, prayed for God to allow them to see her hanged from a ship's mast. That's according to Spanish historian German Vasquez Chimarro. The Portuguese envoy to the court of Fez, a man named Sebastian de Vargas, described her as, quote, a very aggressive and bad-tempered woman about everything.
Okay, when I read that quote, I was like, of course he said that. Like,
of course. If you're picking up a little pattern here, it's this. Much of what we know about Aisha is from sources that are either Portuguese or Spanish writings. That makes them the writings of her enemies.
By 1541, she was ruling Tetuan. She had become powerful and she had developed a reputation, good or bad, depending on which side you were on. The Wattasid Sultan of Morocco proposed marriage. Again, more of a diplomatic alliance than any sort of love and romance, and allowed her to dictate her own terms for the arrangement. Their dynasty had been established and ruling in Morocco since the 13th century, and in a power move, she accepted the deal, but she refused to travel to Fez, his land, to marry him. He, though, the story goes, did travel to marry her, and it's the only instance on record of a Moroccan king marrying outside of his capital. It's said that they lived in their respective cities. The union, though, made Sayyida al-Hura a true pirate queen.
But the dynasty's influence was on the wane, and another sultanate, the Saadi, were on the rise. From 1509 to 1549, the Saadi had ruled in the south of Morocco. They were restless, plus there was upheaval in the city and open war with Portugal. All of this mixed together to give those who might have wanted to overthrow their queen an opportunity to do so. And it came from within her own family. It was Ahmed al-Hassan al-Mandari, a relative to her first husband and her son-in-law, who took this opportunity. One of two things happened here. He gave intel to the enemies of her royal husband, who then overtook her rule, or, alternately, he arrived in Tetuan with a small army to overthrow his mother-in-law himself.
In either scenario, in 1542, Aisha's rule and life of piracy ended. She was an intelligent and powerful woman and leader, and the influence she had in the Mediterranean was extraordinary. As a pirate, she accomplished what many could not, a long life. Aisha ruled for more than 30 years. It wasn't battle that bested her in the end. She was deposed in 1542 by her son-in-law. She did not die as a pirate, which was almost always execution by hanging. Instead, she lived the remainder of her life in Chefchaouen, Morocco, which was her childhood city, until her death in 1561 at the age of 75.
Hesna Lebedi, author of Feminist Traditions in Andalusi Moroccan Oral Narratives, considers Aisha among the Andalusian Moroccan heroines who populate the region's history and are woven into the folklore. But she continues, quote, "To refer to her as pirate is to put the blame on those who were defending their land from aggressive colonial powers." Maria, would you like to step into the groggery with me?
I would. I hear it's ladies' night.
It is, in fact. The name of this drink, because I wanted to hearken to that last quote we read that kind of reframes how we look at Aisha.
Right. And some of the other pirates we've had this season.
Right. And I wanted to make something that uses that kind of language, and I borrowed from another quote, but makes something absolutely delicious and wonderful. So this is called The Bad-Tempered Woman.
I hear she's ill-tempered in every way.
Oh, this drink is not ill-tempered. It is delightful and kind. This is a super duper easy one to do. It takes a few ingredients, but not too many. You are going to, first of all, boil together on your stove in a, you know, a little small saucepan with a couple of cups of water, a mint tea bag, a green tea bag, and a little bit of minced ginger, like a tablespoon.
Mm-hmm. We're going in a good direction. I like it.
Just as it comes to a boil, you're going to go ahead and cut the heat. There's one little trick you have to do here. Green tea can get a little bit bitter if it steeps too long. As it hits like the 2.5 to 3 minute zone, pull the green tea bag out, but leave the mint tea bag in. If you're using loose tea, same rule applies. Just put them into, or at least the green tea into a strainer, like a drop-in strainer that you can pull out because you don't want it to mess anything up. You want that mint tea to really, really steep and like be the primary flavor here. While that's happening, you are going to get an orange out and you are going to cut a nice kind of fat slice. And then you are also going to need a sprig of mint and you are going to take about 10 mint leaves. I like a lot of mint, obviously. So you're going to muddle that one slice of orange, leave the skin on and everything. You just cut it as a slice and those 10 mint leaves. And you're going to muddle with an ounce of simple syrup involved just to give it some slosh. And then we've only just begun because what you're going to do now is you're going to put in 1.5 ounces of gin.
Gin? Where are you going?
You're going to want to go ahead and put some ice in because you're about to put in tea that's probably still a little warm. So you want to do this part quickly. Drop your ice in, drop in 2 ounces of tea, and then just start shaking that thing like the Dickens. Give it a good hard shake. Strain this over ice, and you can garnish it with a sprig of mint. And if you want to do a cute little twist of orange or get your channel knife out and make something cute, you can do that. Hello, refreshment. This turned out so much better than I ever could have imagined because I was worried about the green tea oversteeping.
Right.
I wasn't sure if the gin was going to party or if it was going to be problematic. It is, in fact, great. You can't even taste that there's alcohol in it, which is dangerous. So.
Yes, but good when it's gin because I don't want to taste the gin.
Be careful and drink responsibly if you make this. This is obviously one that is super duper easy to make as a non-alcoholic version. All you have to do for your mocktail is just leave the gin out. And you could maybe just up the amount of tea. Like the gin really vanishes. It doesn't offer much in terms of flavor profile. Mm-hmm. So with the orange and the mint and the green tea all together, you're going to get pretty close to the same flavor, even without the gin involved.
I love that there's citrus in this drink. I love when citrus shows up.
There's citrus, there's gin. There are things that I shouldn't want to put in a drink, and I did. And part of it is I was trying to use things that often show up in Moroccan beverages. So like mint is very common, citrus is super common. And so I wanted to find a way to marry those and make something interesting and refreshing that is delightful on the palate and not at all bad-tempered, even though it is called a bad-tempered woman.
It's a marriage of alliance instead of a marriage of love.
I don't know. This is a marriage of love. I mean,
it's got gin in it. I can't give it a marriage of love.
Listen, you know, gin is not my spirit of choice. And yet I made one. I went about my day. And when work time was over, I made another because it's so yummy.
I will follow your lead on that, despite the fact that it is not my favorite.
I'm telling you, that mint and orange together does something so beautiful. For anybody that doesn't love gin, but maybe wants to dabble in it, this is a great entree point, I think, because you're not going to get kind of slapped in the face with that juniper that is often so off-putting for people that don't love gin.
Yeah.
If you make that or the mocktail version, I hope you enjoy it. It is really quite refreshing and lovely. We are so grateful that you spent this time in the groggery with us, as well as the rest of the episode. We will be right back here next week with another tale of piracy and another hopefully delicious libation. Criminalia is a production of Shondaland Audio in partnership with iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from Shondaland Audio, please visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.